There has been an accident. It was sad. It happened in London. And as so often happens, I think there have been 8 deaths in cyclists already so far this year. This one, I don't know what the result was, I just got it from the internet, but there's been this accident. It's at night, and there are 5 witnesses that we're going to be looking at in a little while, and you are the jurors at the inquest. Okay, so you're going to have to decide which of these witnesses is the ones that you're going to trust. Okay? And there are going to be 2 questions that the barrister is going to ask just to discover how accurate the witnesses are. So you're going to be the jurors who are going to have to make that decision as to which you think are the more accurate. Now let's see the first witness. There's a handsome man with a beard, and he says, yes, I was there, and I saw it happen. Okay, so what does he have to say? Well, he says, and he's being asked the questions about what did the cyclist wearing and what was the cyclist doing, and so he says, the cyclist was wearing a dark navy jacket, and the cyclist had his hand out to turn left. Right, so that's the first of the witnesses, just one person. Now, let's have a look at the next set of witnesses. This time we've got 4 people. They were in a group. And they also say, we were there, we saw it. Now, when they're asked separately by the barrister what they saw, and they're asked these questions, what was the cyclist wearing and what was the cyclist doing, these are the results. This is what they say. One of them says he was wearing a black anorak. The next one says it was a green jacket. The third one isn't even sure what it was. And the fourth one is very honest and says, I couldn't see what he was wearing. And then about what the cyclist was doing, well, they have, again, 4 different answers on that. Not maybe a great difference, but this is just to discover how accurate the witnesses are likely to be. Now, here's the question, which Trevor will carry around with the mic. Anyone can answer this. Who would you trust? Would you trust the one person who said, I saw it and I'm very definite, or would you trust the 4 people? Well, we'll have a bit of different answers. Who do you feel is more trustworthy on that? Who would you choose as the ones that you'd say, well, would it be the one person or would it be the 4 people that you would trust?
Any opinions?
There we go. You're the jury. You have to make up your mind on who you would regard as the trustworthy ones.
I think I would trust the one on his own.
Right, okay. Any others giving a viewpoint?
I would be inclined towards the one, but I'd take what he says with a pinch of salt.
Right. Any others? We'll have one more answer.
I would pick clues from all of them, especially with the dress that the cyclist was wearing. All of them seem to have a colored dress, so I would take all of the 5. Actually.
Oh, he's going for both. Yeah, well, it's not allowed, but that's okay. Right, okay, let's move on to the next slide. Now, when it comes to Bible texts and the original documents, the fact is that the scholars always trust more than less. Very interesting thing. It may be counterintuitive, maybe not what we expect. But actually, there is more validity in the many than in the one, because even if the one says very definitely, I was there and I saw it, there's nothing to corroborate that. And you remember in the Old Testament it says that no one is to be judged guilty unless there is more than one witness. So when you're next in the jury, remember that it has to be more than one. Next slide. But although there are differences, and here the one and the five do agree, there are at least three things that we can say. There was an accident, the cyclist was hit by the car, and the cyclist was injured. Okay, well, what does all this have to do with the question that we're looking at today, which is the Bible reliable? And I'm going to look at it in three ways, three different aspects to it. First of all, the original texts, that's the manuscripts. Secondly, the translations. And thirdly, the most important thing of all, which is really, in a sense, it doesn't matter, even if the Bible is absolutely reliable, unless it's reliable for us, unless I think it's reliable, and I'm willing to trust my life to what the Bible says. So first of all, let's see, what is it that we have in the texts themselves? Well, there's, were the Bible writers reliable? The text itself. More evidence, and we're going to look at this one by one. The Dead Sea Scrolls. So here it is. Now, on the, on your left, on the left there, you've probably heard of the Dead Sea Scrolls and the Qumran Caves. There's an amazing story. There was a Bedouin boy who was living in the desert. They're shepherds in Palestine. And he noticed that there was a cave or some sort of thing right up there in the cliff there. And so he picked up a stone and he threw it, and it went through the opening, and then he heard tinkle, tinkle, he heard a crash. And that was way back in 1946. Well, what was it that they'd found? If you look at the next one, the middle picture, that's a picture of what was inside. It's amazing that these jars had stayed undiscovered for over 2,000 years. And this is probably the most important Bible discovery of the 20th century. That these jars contain scrolls, and there's a scroll on the right, that have been left undisturbed for over 2,000 years. And when they opened them, and it was very fragile, very difficult to get these documents open, but when they finally did open them, they discovered that a lot of them were about the book of Isaiah. And they were able to compare a manuscript from 2,000 years ago with the manuscripts or the Bible text that we use today, and found that they were very, very similar. And this is one of the things that has given the greatest impression to the reliability of the text. The fact that we can find documents which have not been seen for 2,000 years, and they're very, very close to the ones that we use today. So that's the first thing, the Dead Sea Scrolls. Now, let's look at the second area that we have of reliability. And it's about papyrus. Now, you may know about papyrus. This is made in Egypt. Usually it's made from reeds, and they're put together, one on top of the other, all different ways, balanced, so that they're then pushed together. And when they're left to dry, then you can write on them. And a lot of manuscripts, particularly of the New Testament, were written on these papyri. So just like the Dead Sea Scrolls being discovered in the 20th century, there was a lot more of these New Testament papyri that were discovered in the last century. In 1900, there were only 9 of these that had so far been discovered. But by the end of the century, there were almost 100. And each of these ones brings new light. It's like the witnesses that we saw with the cyclist and the crash. More and more witnesses are establishing more and more the reliability of the text that we now have. And then the third area, which gives us a great sense of reliability, is what's called the oral tradition. Now, there was a lot of prejudice against this 100 years ago. You know, if you couldn't read and write, well, you really were a non-person. And a lot of the world 100 years ago, of course, was illiterate. Even today, there are still a large number of the world's population who can't read and write. And so when the people talked about, well, it's being an oral tradition, it's a story which has been related from grandfather to son to grandson to great-grandson and so on, who can believe whether that can be accurate? Well, what we find, and the anthropologists in the last century has done a great job for us, they've discovered that actually it can be very accurate, that people who are illiterate tend to have very good memories. It's like people who are blind. If you've ever met a blind person, often they have very good hearing and they have very good spatial sense. So they're making up for the lack of one thing by being excellent in other areas. And this is true with the oral tradition, that actually it is possible to give the same story through the generations, decade by decade, even century by century. So these three things we have. We have the authority of the original manuscripts, we have the authority of the papyri, and even the oral tradition. So when some people say, oh, well, this is just handed down from father to son or whatever, is it really true? I think we can say, yes, it is. So the first thing we can be sure about is the reliability of the documents themselves. Well, the second question you might ask is, well, okay, even if the documents are reliable, what about the translation? Is the translation going to be reliable? Well, there is a test that the translators do, and they put all the translations on what's called a continuum, on a single line. So let's have a look at that single line. And this is what they do in English. Now, let's just try and understand what's going on here. On the left, you see translations which are called word for word. That is, whatever the word is in Hebrew or whatever the word is in Greek is trying to be translated into English words which mean exactly the same. But on the other side is what are called meaning-based translations, where you take a whole phrase or a whole sentence, because in Hebrew and in Greek, it's really quite different from what it is in English. So you have some which are more word for word, the King James Version, what we call the Authorized Version. And on the other side, we have the Good News or the Contemporary English Version. And in the middle, you have on the left the English Standard Version, which is a more literal word for word. And then right in the middle, you have the NIV, the Nearly Infallible Version, which is the one that we use. And the reason we use it is because it seeks to combine both word for word and meaning. Now, this is a bit of a technical subject, but when you compare these different translations, you can see how they work. If you look at the King James, and then you look at the Good News, you'll say, well, it's slightly different. It's almost sometimes seems to be saying slightly different things. Well, the reason for that is the way that they're translated. Now, is one right and one wrong? I'm going to give you the answer on that a little later. Okay, next one. Now, I'm going to give you an example of where it's impossible to have a totally literal translation. You might think, well, that's the goal. That's what we want to find. We want really a totally literal translation. Isn't that what we're after? Well, I'm going to give an example from Exodus. And this is where it says, Moses went out from Pharaoh in hot anger. Now, that is not exactly what the Hebrew says. What the Hebrew says is, literally, in heat of nose. Moses went out from Pharaoh in heat of nose. Now, when the first English translators of the Bible, like Wycliffe and Tyndale, did the translation, they thought, we don't know anything about heat of nose. We don't talk about heat of nose. So we'll change it to say something about anger. We won't translate it literally. I think that's a great pity. Just suppose, next one, supposing we'd created, or they'd created, a phrase like nosy heat, and they'd said Pharaoh was a nosy heat person. Wouldn't that be nice? You know, today we can talk about people who are really angry. We can say they're nosy heat people. I think that would be great. But anyway, the translators did choose not to do that, and you can't say that anymore. But that's an example of where even the most literal translations never translate exactly what the words are, because to our ears, they sound a bit funny. If I go out and say someone was in nosy heat, we wouldn't really know what they were talking about. Well, asking the question, which are more reliable? The answer is, it all depends who it's for. If you're going to do study, serious word-for-word study, and you want to get back to the original as closely as you can, you're going to choose something like the English Standard Version, because it's very, very literal. On the other hand, if you're teaching in L zone, or if you're wanting to read through the text consecutively, just all at one time, say a gospel all at one time, you're much more likely to choose the Good News or the CEV. So we can say, to add up to what we've been saying this morning, the text, the original documents are reliable, and the translations that we have are reliable also. It just depends, in terms of the translation, what the goal is, who your audience is, what you want to do. So that's the first part, and then a little later on I'll look briefly at not just is the Bible reliable, but is it reliable for me in my life? Well, we've got the first parts. We've seen the way that the Bible is reliable. The documents are reliable and the translations are reliable. Now, what does the Bible mean for me? What does it mean for you? Sometimes we have that picture of the person with his hand on the handle of the word. And the five fingers represent different things. Now let's just see what they represent. These are the five